It's Friday, May 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a new truce tentatively holds in Syria.
I think it's going to be an event that's going to be really focused on Kim Jong-un.
North Korea prepares for a meeting not held in 40 years. Also ahead, the U.S. Justice Department weighs in on a controversial state law, a big opponent for Donald Trump, and it's not who you think. It's all on today's International Edition. A 48-hour ceasefire prevails over Syria's embattled largest city following a flurry of diplomatic activity led by the United States and Russia after 2 weeks of fighting that left some 300 civilians dead. Ceasefire monitors from both countries expect the truce, which began just after midnight Thursday, to last until midnight Friday local time. Speaking in Washington Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the ceasefire was beginning to take hold, but said it must prevail throughout the country if there's to be any hope of restarting stalled proximity talks in Geneva on Syria's political transition.
We expect all the parties to the cessation of hostilities to fully abide by the renewed cessation in Aleppo. That means the regime and the opposition alike. And we also expect them to live by the cessation throughout the country, pursuant to the terms that were arrived at and agreed upon in Munich in February of this year. And we look to Russia as a co-chair of the International Syria Support Group, since they have the strongest relationship, apparently, with the regime, to press them for the regime's compliance with this effort.
Kerry said Washington and Moscow have teams in Geneva closely coordinating truce monitoring efforts. Middle East analyst and former State Department official Peter Bechtold, an adjunct professor at Oregon State University, was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty what might happen once the two-day ceasefire over Aleppo ends.
The hope is that this can be extended. Just like war is being extended, so ceasefires can be extended. At least that's the hope.
This does not cover the terrorist groups like Islamic State or al-Nusra, which are fairly close to Aleppo, so there's the chance that the militants will continue attacks.
Exactly. In my opinion, it's never smart to freeze out some members of a conflict and keep others in. Part of the city is controlled by the Nusra Front, part of it is controlled by the rebels, and part of it is controlled by the government. And there's even a small Kurdish enclave.
Let's talk about the overall strategic picture here. It appears that Aleppo seems to be a key objective for both sides. One or the other may ultimately prevail in this five-year conflict if they're able to secure Aleppo. Is that your opinion?
Oh, yes. Aleppo, before the war started, was the most populous city in Syria. It's been a key place in history, and you could argue that it's strategically more important on the route of the Fertile Crescent, connecting Turkey with the Arab world. You have to more or less go through Aleppo, and also connecting Iraq and Syria.
Both sides are heavily invested in this. Obviously, you've underscored the strategic value of Aleppo, so isn't it in the interest of both sides ultimately to try to retake it, which means more violence?
Well, it doesn't have to be that. Muslims, Christians, Jews, even Druze, Kurds, they've lived side by side.
What does this all tell you about the dynamic between the U.S. and Russia? Does Russia seem to hold the cards here?
They hold some cards. They certainly hold more cards than the U.S. does. But they don't hold as many cards as they did 2 months ago, because they have pulled out the majority of their forces. The main card that they hold is that they seem to have influence with the government of President Assad. And the assumption is that the United States has influence with those rebels who have received American assistance. And that if you take those two into a ceasefire, you're still left with al-Nusra and the Islamic State, and you're left with the Kurds, and they have to be included in an overall settlement.
How likely is the proximity talks in Geneva to resume and become more substantive than they have?
If the ceasefire holds for 48 hours, that's the time for Geneva to work as hard as they can and see if they can come up with a political accommodation. You have to walk back some of the positions.
Peter Bechtold says that means the parties must be prepared to drop all preconditions to the talks, including the opposition demand that President Bashar al-Assad step down first. Well, it's time now for our social media segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio where, here in the United States, it's still Thursday, May the 5th. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. That means it's Cinco de Mayo.
Cinco de Mayo to you.
Same to you, too. Well, Cinco de Mayo is not a big holiday in Mexico from I hear, but it's quite popular here in America for some reason. And that's why it's one of the top trending hashtags at this hour. But Republican frontrunner Donald Trump may be contributing to that topic's popularity online. He posted a video of himself posing with Taco Bell on Facebook and Twitter and captioned it, "Happy Cinco de Mayo. The best taco bowls are made in Trump Tower Grill." I love Hispanics.
Yeah, I saw that. And there's a little bit of controversy as well as to whether his restaurant even sells that dish, right?
Absolutely, especially on his Twitter. And Jim, as you mentioned earlier during break, the name grill implies that it doesn't really serve Mexican food, isn't it right?
It's possible, yeah.
Yeah, they could add one item. So one person pointed out that the restaurant doesn't even serve that dish, and other people argued it's a Cinco de Mayo special that's been around for years. Others still argued that it's not true, according to a reporter who just called the grill. The conversation on Facebook took a different note. One of the most popular replies says, "We Trump supporters love Hispanic American citizens. The legal ones, that is." Ouch. Hispanic supporters of Trump also left supportive messages.
Okay, well, what else are the people talking about online?
Hashtag DropoutHillary is a trending hashtag. It's been trending since GOP contenders Ted Cruz and John Kasich dropped out of the race. Neither of the Republican contenders are commenting on it, but guess who is? Green Party candidate Jill Stein. She tweeted, "Seeing hashtag DropoutHillary and hashtag RepublicansForHillary show how divisive the corporate front running candidates are. Let's choose a different path." That got more than 4,000 likes. Also buzzing online is a Holocaust Remembrance Day called Yom HaShoah. It's a day to commemorate around 6 million Jews who died during that ethnic cleansing. That's all for me today, Jim.
Well, thank you for the wrap-up, G. You can tweet your questions and comments to our Twitter account, at VOA underscore IE. You can tag me and G in those tweets. We're at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. This is VOA. Here are some of the top stories that are trending now in Asia. East Asia trio agree to boost maritime security. Malaysia facing bankruptcy due to 1MDB scandal, warns ex-prime minister. North Korea is set to celebrate Kim Jong-un's era. Despite ceasefire, Myanmar landmine scourge goes unaddressed. Vietnam bans unsafe seafood in central provinces. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on our website, voanews.com, and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. North Korea's Party Congress opens today, and according to analysts in Seoul and Washington, it will serve as a political tool to cement Kim Jong-un's rule. The 7th Congress of the North's ruling Workers' Party is the first in nearly 40 years. The Congress is likely to last several days. In the past, the event drew many delegates from around the world. In 1980, for instance, nearly 180 delegates from 118 countries attended the gathering. This time, the North is known to have invited only a handful of foreign delegates to the event, and despite the low profile, the Congress will give Kim an opportunity to assume center stage before a large domestic audience. That includes more than 3,000 delegates from around the nation. The gathering comes amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula following Pyongyang's fourth nuclear test in January. VOA's Steve Miller discusses the intended impact of the meeting with Adam Cathcart. He's editor-in-chief of SinoNK.com website, about some of the missile tests as well leading up to the event.
A lot of times you're not overly surprised when you see this now from North Korea. It kind of goes into their usual cycle of provocation and then look at negotiation. And you can kind of flip that on the other side. It works both ways for them. So I can't say that there was a lot of surprise. And as you know, with the Worker Party Congress coming up, there's a lot of pressure on Kim Jong-un to have what he would term as accomplishments in the security field, things that he can point to solidify his base and show that he's made achievements. So, I mean, there's been so much in the last few months with starting off with the nuclear test, the fourth nuclear test, the multiple long-range missile tests, the last two, which have been kind of failures, the work on miniaturization, the submarine missile launches as well. So there's been all of that has been kind of building up to this this meeting.
There's a lot of speculation as to what the purpose of this meeting is, the first time in 36 years. Do you have any expectations of what we may see or any predictions about what may take place at that Congress meeting?
And I think it's going to be an event that's going to be really focused on Kim Jong-un and really focused on kind of trying to coalesce all of the things that have basically since he's taken over, and really trying to kind of assert that to his role at the top. I mean, I think that's really been what's been happening. We've been seeing over the past few years a lot of purges of key individuals, whether they be in the military and the political circles around Kim Jong-un. So I think that this is going to be really kind of a statement, so to say. I don't really know that we're going to see anything, any massive announcement. We potentially might, but I think it's going to be some of the theatrics around this event. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of pomp involved in it, and we may very well see a fifth nuclear test right before or surrounding that event.
How would you paraphrase or how would you word the current state of affairs between Pyongyang and Beijing, between North Korea and China?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, if I was to say one word, obviously complicated in the sense that, I said China's in a tough spot. They're in a very tough spot. They are tied to North Korea in so many ways, with it kind of being a buffer between it and the United States, troops there and the presence there, and the potential for instability there. But they also see the security element of it. So it's becoming a bit of a severe nuisance for China. But it's a complicated relationship for sure.
And we'll keep you up to date as that Congress continues to meet. On VOAnews.com and also on Twitter at VOA_IE. Trending on Chinese social media is the marriage of an American diplomat based in China and his partner. Despite the gay Chinese couple's recent failed attempt to win the right to be married, Hanscom Smith, currently a consul general in Shanghai, and his longtime partner Eric Liu found a way to dodge the problem Tuesday as they were officially pronounced husband and husband in San Francisco City Hall. Meanwhile, the U.S. Justice Department says a controversial new law in North Carolina limiting protections for gay, lesbians, bisexual, and transgender people violates federal civil rights law and must not be enforced. Chris Scrow is a Democratic state lawmaker in North Carolina and the executive director of Equality NC, an LGBT rights group. He shares his reaction to the development with International Edition host Susan Yockey.
The letter from the Justice Department really confirms what we already know, which is that House Bill 2 is deeply discriminatory, that it violates federal civil rights law, and that it needs to be repealed in full as soon as possible.
Maybe you could explain to us what the law says.
Yeah, so this is the worst anti-LGBT law that has been passed at least this session in quite some time across the whole country. It forces transgender people to use the wrong bathroom. It bars municipalities from setting protection and public accommodations or several other realms on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. It strips back existing protections in municipalities like the city of Charlotte. It also prohibits raising minimum wage at the city level, and it also eliminates the cause of action for racial discrimination and gender discrimination in state court here in North Carolina.
I have a little article in front of me, and it says the North Carolina law limits legal protections for members of the LGBT community and requires transgender people to use only public bathroom facilities that correspond to the gender listed on their birth certificates. So they'd have to have their birth certificate with them, and you are obviously against this. You know, a lot of our listeners are overseas, and they may not understand why this is so important in this country. In some countries, it's actually illegal to be gay.
Right. I mean, I think that we should hold ourselves to a high standard here in the United States in terms of civil rights laws. I think that that's what the Justice Department said the other day. And these are protections that do exist in many other parts of the United States on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity in 100-plus cities and 17 states across the country. So they're certainly not uncommon in this country, and I know that they're not uncommon in other parts of the world as well, but they really are critical for members of the gay and transgender community in their everyday lives. And as I said, House Bill 2 goes a lot farther than that in the way that it impacts your ability to bring suit on the basis of racial or gender discrimination.
You can visit voanews.com for more on this story. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has been no stranger to controversy. In fact, he seems to embrace it. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins me in the studio with an opponent Mr. Trump may find more difficult than Hillary Clinton.
Donald Trump is going up against something even bigger than the Democratic Party, the Rolling Stones. They want Trump to stop using their music at his rallies. Now, he's used their songs for months, among them You Can't Always Get What You Want and Start Me Up. Well, on Wednesday, the Stones issued a statement saying they did not give Donald Trump permission to use their music, and they would like him to cease and desist. Now, at this time, the Trump campaign has yet to respond. This isn't the first time that the Donald has bumped heads with some musical stars. He's also used music from Elton John, Adele, and Aerosmith. Now, Adele and Steve Tyler of Aerosmith both asked Trump to stop using their songs. So did Neil Young. Trump was using Rockin' in the Free World last year. The Trump campaign did comply in those cases. They stopped using the songs. Political campaigns don't need artists' permission to use their songs as long as the organization or the venue has obtained a blanket license from the BMI or ASCAP performing rights organizations. Now, BMI says it does have a provision in its licensing agreement that allows songwriters or publishers to object to the use of their songs, and they do have the right to exclude those particular songs from the blanket licensing. So I suppose the Stones could go that way. if they license their songs through BMI. You know, this isn't the first time that politicians have run afoul of music artists. There's kind of a long history of sometimes tone-deaf usage of these songs. And the one that really sticks out in my mind is the Ronald Reagan campaign's usage of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA in the 1984 presidential election. And, of course, Reagan was using it in a patriotic sense, when in fact, if you listen to the song, it's very sharply critical of the U.S. and its policies. So I think sometimes the campaign workers really need to listen to the music a little more carefully before they put it on the PA system. So we'll just have to wait and see how the Trump campaign reacts to this latest request from the Stones.
Yeah, campaigns over the years have made some very interesting musical choices. And I'm glad you answered that question about the licensing, because I always wondered what that was all about with the public performance angle of it. And because not just anybody can go out and play songs like that in a public performance setting. There are laws and licensing requirements.
Well, more often than not, the politicians back down and stop using the songs, at least temporarily. But they have a pretty plentiful supply of other songs to choose from.
We talked about this outside of the studio. Perhaps Get Off My Cloud is the appropriate Stone song for
and you can't always
Trump
get
campaign.
What you want, Donald.
Absolutely. Well, we get what we want every time we speak with Ray McDonald. He's our Top 20 Countdown host. Follow Ray on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thank you, Ray.
You got it.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can always find us, you know where, voanews.com. Like us on Facebook when you can, at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Carl Starling is our engineer. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for spending some time with us, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Although the fight for political freedom is a universal challenge, three African nations, Burundi, Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Republic of Congo, experienced a significant increase in human rights abuses related to their elections in 2015. Burundi's human rights climate took a turn for the worse in April 2015 when the ruling political party, the National Council for the Defense of Democracy, Forces for the Defense of Democracy, announced that the incumbent president, Pierre Nkurunziza, would run for a third term, which he won in July 2015, in violation of the Arusha Agreement. Human rights monitors have documented at least 474 individuals killed since April 2015, including 130 targeted assassinations. Other serious human rights abuses linked to the political crisis include extrajudicial killings, arbitrary and politicized detention, often in inhuman and life-threatening conditions, and widespread government disregard for the freedoms of speech, press and media, assembly and association, and sexual and gender-based violence. In the Republic of the Congo on October 25th, the ruling Congolese Labor Party and its allies won a landslide victory in a referendum to amend the constitution to allow President Denis Sassou Nguesso to run for a third term. 35 civilians were reported killed during demonstrations leading up to the referendum, and voters faced intimidation and severe restrictions on basic freedoms. In January 2015, political tensions intensified in the Democratic Republic of Congo when protests erupted in Kinshasa, Goma, and Bukavu over a push by President Joseph Kabila's presidential majority for electoral legislation mandating a nationwide census that would have delayed presidential elections past 2016. The United Nations Joint Human Rights Office confirmed 10 deaths, while Human Rights Watch reported 38 civilian deaths, 5 disappearances, and more than 300 arrests during the protests. Additionally, there were numerous reports of opposition members arrested in cities across the country. abuses have continued to increase. The UN has stated that it has documented more than 400 cases of human rights violations, including 52 arrests since the beginning of 2016. In all three cases, the United States has expressed concerns for these trends both publicly and privately. Universally, it is the primary responsibility of the state to address human rights abuses through accountability and prevention. This is a challenge all over the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.